Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Player Development First podcast. This is episode 4. We've got Michael Carroll with us today. Michael is the Player Development Director at SG1 Soccer Club in Katy, Texas. Michael works a lot with the U6, U7, U8 age group and is really knowledgeable about possessional methodologies within those ages. He's done his TOVO licenses. He's done his COVER licenses as well. His Twitter is at Texas Coach Mike, and I'd really recommend giving him a follow. He has a lot of great content on there and, you know, a lot of great anecdotes about his methodology. So really good one today. Really appreciate Mike coming on and everyone listening. Thanks very much. Hope you enjoy it. Hey, Michael, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hey, no problem. I'm happy to be here, man. Always happy to talk.
Great. Michael, where did you grow up and what was your first involvement in soccer?
I can't remember not being involved in soccer. My mother was a soccer player and her brother, and I started from the earliest ages. Like, I think I was playing in a little rec league at like age 3 or 4. Right. Yeah. And so I can't ever remember not being involved in soccer. It was a big part of my life growing up. On the field is where a kid can always like feel safe. Right.
Yeah.
And so it was a big part of my life. I grew up in the first half of my life up to age 12. I was in Irving, Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth area. And went to school there. And then at age 12, we moved to the Houston area when I was 12, and we moved to Houston. I bounced around a little bit here in Houston. We ended up landing in La Porte, which is south side of Houston, southeast.
Okay.
Side of the Houston area in the La Porte, Pasadena, Deer Park area. And then I went to middle school and the majority of my high school time in La Porte, at La Porte High School. Uh-huh. And then in my senior year, I moved back into Irving and I ended up graduating from Irving MacArthur.
Okay, yeah.
There, phenomenal head coach at Irving MacArthur, Coach John Fizikas, absolutely amazing coach, did wonders with me. And in the 1 year he had me, he was fantastic.
What position did you play?
Right winger. I was a 7.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes an 11. I mean, I float around, but they kept me out wide.
All right.
Yeah. And then I slept on the beach for 6 months. before my mom told me I had to make a decision with my life. Right. I attended Southwest Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri for a little bit. But apparently you actually have to go to class. That's kind of a thing that you have to do. So they don't just let you show up and play soccer.
Yeah.
And I think they renamed the school now like Southern Missouri State or something. Then I went back home and I ended up joining the Navy, United States Navy, which was probably the smartest move I ever made.
Yeah.
I played soccer for the Navy men's team while I was there. So what they do is they basically, the competition, at least then, was like Division II, Division III colleges, a lot of like recruiting, maybe recruiting, okay, kind of stuff, yeah, too. Right. Yeah, yeah. The young guys come at you from those JUCOs and they're like, you get to play soccer in the Navy.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, see. And so that was kind of where I started my coaching. I was in Seattle, Washington for a bit, actually Bremerton, which is just outside Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we were going to be there for a while, the ship that I was attached to. And I had been asked to do some volunteer work out in the city somewhere while we're there, keep myself busy and out of trouble. Yeah. Is what they try to keep the boys doing, right?
Yeah, that's what I was just picturing there. I was like, you're on a ship. I was like, I'm just, for some reason in my head, I've got you know, people in the Navy just doing like rondos or something on the deck. But as I guess you're playing these games when you're docked up.
Yes, in Seaside. Occasionally, we would have a game against, when we would travel, we would have, the ship had a team. The ship I was attached to, we had a little team on the ship as well. And I got a couple of games in, and like, we got a game in Tasmania against some locals, and Perth there in the Australia area. And we played a game in Japan. So, I mean, I got in some games in other places.
I'm sure it's just incredible experiences traveling and playing. I'm sure it's not all that glamorous. Yeah.
And so I decided to volunteer. I am maybe 22 years old at the time at the local YMCA in Seattle, right? And I'd never coached before at all. And so I walked in and I was like, hey, I want to volunteer. And they were like, what are you capable of doing? Right. And I said, well, I'm a soccer player. I can play soccer. And they were like, good. Here's a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds. Go enjoy that. Yeah. Right. And I'm 22, no wife or kids or anything on my own. Right. And I was very ill equipped mentally to handle a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds at the time. And I'm certain I did a horrendous job. I was terrible at it. Right. No idea what I was doing, but I really did enjoy the kids. They were a lot of fun, and we had a lot of fun that first season, and which is kind of what the YMCA is about, you sure. know, enjoying and having fun and stuff. And so I went back again for a second season to stay, you know, and keep doing it. And then that's kind of where I decided, you know, this is kind of a cool deal. And so I just kept volunteering for a long time till this was 1995. And so I kept volunteering until early 2000s, you know, as a 2007, 2008.
So what was your like career path from, you know, you're in the Navy all the way until your current role now at SG1? What was your career path?
So in the Navy, I was a firefighter on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. And so when we weren't flying, I was basically just doing busy work. But after I got out of the military in 2002, I just kept volunteering for local sports organizations. A couple of times with the YMCA. We have a group here. You're probably familiar with FFPS. I volunteered with the Funfair Positive Soccer a few times, and I just kept volunteering and starting to work on my badges, my coaching licenses, mm-hmm. right? And I wasn't doing any USSF stuff, though. I was doing all, like, NFCAA.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'd done a couple of those courses. I'd done the Advanced National and the National. Yeah, I thought they were – I really liked their outlook on it. I loved the aspect of going in and for the Advanced National anyway, going and watching – you know, a college game and then planning a session around the unit. I just thought they'd done a great job with that.
I actually preferred the NSCAA stuff to the United States Soccer Federation stuff. At the time, USSF was more mandatory.
Yeah.
for stuff. Yeah. Like, but the NSCAA, I really enjoyed doing their courses. So about 10 years ago, I applied for a position with Corver, right? And I became a Corver instructor. And then after I'd been a Corver instructor for a little bit, I went on with the local club here in Houston. And I stayed with them for 6 years.
Wow.
What's that?
With Corver, sorry, with the local club.
With the local club, yeah. And so I was with the local club for 6 years. And then a year and a half ago, I parted ways with them and accepted a position as Director of Player Development with SG1 Soccer Club.
Awesome, man. And, you know, it's a very unique role.
It is, yeah.
What does your role of player development director involve? Like, what do you do on a weekly basis? Do you provide additional feedback or what are you doing?
Yeah, so my first job was to establish our club's development methodology, That was the first thing that I was essentially brought in to do. I'd been having some success as a grassroots coordinator and camp coordinator and stuff at my previous club. I'd done a lot of studying on developing young players, right? And I had pretty much made the decision that I was going to stay in those young youth age groups at that point. I didn't really have a desire to quote unquote climb the ranks.
Sure.
Whatever that really means.
What age group is that you're talking about? Like, is that like U6, U7, U8,
U9? U10 and younger.
Okay, yeah.
So I primarily work with U6, U7, U8. And so that's my primary goal, is to make sure we get that right. Right? Because if you get that right, it makes everything easier down the road with your club. Getting that right is super important. If you get that wrong, you either become a development club or a recruiting club at that point.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you get your grassroots development wrong, you're a recruiting club at U9, U10, U11, looking for players, going out trying to sign more players, hosting tryouts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
If you get that right, then recruiting's not as big of a necessity, right?
Yeah.
Because you're building your teams from your grassroots program instead of going out and saying, hey, you should leave them and come to us, and you should leave them and come to us, right? Yeah. Trying to recruit players and whatnot. You shouldn't find an SG1 coach doing that at all now. It's not a necessity for us. We're building all of our teams through our grassroots development. So
what was a big part of your methodology there? Sorry.
What's that?
What was a big part of your methodology that you established when you first came?
Yeah. So because of my background in Corver, right? And so I the first thing that I did was I established at the youngest age groups, Corver's technical development and ball mastery was going to be a massive part of developing our players' comfort on the ball, our youngest players' comfort on the ball. From as early as age 4, whenever they decide to start joining our club, they go straight to individual ball mastery. And we start developing a player's comfort on the ball. And then I brought Tovo in with me. I'd been studying Tovo for quite some time. Taking the V1 course and the 7v7 course, right? I took the V1 course in person because I was fortunate enough to have Todd Bean come here to Houston and work with the Dynamo. And so really? I'd gotten a chance to take that course in person there.
Awesome. I've been wanting to take one. I haven't taken one yet. They just look awesome. Their methodology and the background.
It's fantastic. It's the most valuable courses I've ever been on. They get right to the point. And so actually all of our young coaches coming in need to take the 7v7 course. We in our club pays for the 7v7 course for our new coaches that come in.
It's a great background. It's a great grounding for a new coach to get that as their first.
I like that the Tovo 7v7 literally lays out 13 weeks of training sessions. So I'm a big fan of that, and we utilize that as a big portion of our methodology. And so as kids age and improve, then we add phase of play, right? Building out of the back, possession in the final third, transition, whether it be from offense to defense or defense to offense. Mm-hmm. So depending on their level, we don't do phase of play in say 4v4 kids, sure. Right? But once teams hit a high level of say 7v7, we can start really seriously working on phase of play. And so we start phasing out Corver and the technical stuff as kids age up, and we grow the amount of time we're spending on Tovo and phase of play.
Sure.
So
I think one thing that really, because Well, this is 2 weeks in a row that I have I've had an SG1 coach on. So obviously you guys are doing something really well, but I didn't know you even through Ivan. I met Ivan on the C course, but When I first, you know, found your Twitter, maybe I don't know when it was, maybe over a year ago, but I just seen this clip of these kids that looked like about 6 years old, and they were just moving the ball around like Barcelona. So that really, you know, that drew me in. What sort of are you doing a lot of positional play games with those U6, U7, U8 age groups, and how would you structure a session in that regard?
So let's take my 2016s. This is their first season as a group. They were all in our grassroots program prior to Rising Stars, is what we call it, right? And so a typical training session for this group is we do about 20 minutes of straight ball mastery.
Yeah.
One player, one ball, and a variety of ball manipulation moves, working every portion of the foot, inside the foot, outside the foot, sole of the foot, right? And so we'll spend probably about 20 minutes of a 1 hour practice. They get 1 hour right now. Next season, they go to 90 minutes. Okay. But right now we spend about a third of our training just on that. And then we'll spend another 20 minutes working on proper technique of passing and receiving, using primarily the inside of the foot, receiving across the body on the back foot. They're more than capable of doing it.
Yeah.
And so as long as you know how to communicate it to them in a manner that they can comprehend, right? And yeah. I think that that's where most coaches struggle. Most youth coaches struggle, because these players of this age are more than capable of playing at a high level. We drastically underestimate what the 5, 6, and 7 year old is capable of understanding. We just don't give players enough credit. And their biggest obstacle, the 5, 6, 7 year old's biggest obstacle, is our ability to communicate to them in a manner that they can understand.
Sure.
And when you learn how kids learn, when we start understanding how young players learn, how young kids learn, and then we can teach them towards that, then they will absorb anything you throw at them. I mean, there's a reason why it's easier for those kids to learn a second language than it is somebody like me, right? Okay. So their brains are wired to just absorb all of this, as long as you can explain it to them in a manner that they can comprehend.
Sure.
And so, I mean, nothing we do is a secret, to be honest with you. There's nothing I'm doing out there. When you look at, say, my 2015s, and they're knocking the ball all over the place, making 250, 300 passes in a game, in a 40-minute game, really? Right? It's nothing I did was a secret. It's all out here, right? It's just that the ability to communicate it to them and explain to them what we're doing, how we do it, and why we're doing it. And the why is probably the most important part, because if you teach them the why, then they can, if you can make it, help them understand the why, they'll apply that everywhere on the field, not just in that one little situation. They're now able to apply it everywhere, right? And so it just starts opening up their minds. And then when you do it in a positive manner, reinforce their creativity and tell them, you know, I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to guide you, right? And explain to you why this might be a better idea than this, right? They start, they're brimming with confidence.
Awesome. So you've got that, like, I'm just trying to picture your session plan in my head. If you've got that 20 minutes of, like, you know, just straight up ball mastery, getting their foundational touch work there, then you're moving in, and you said, you know, you're working on some of the repetition.
Passing and receiving.
Would that be in like a box sort of a situation, or would that be within like a rondo, or how would you work that?
The rondo and the positional play is the final 20 minutes essentially. Okay. of that training. So it's 2 to 3 players together under no pressure, mm-hmm. just technique, right? It's yeah. just You know, you're not open. Your ball keeps going that way because you're crossing your legs when you pass, or you're not opening your foot up enough, or something like that, right? It's kids need that kind of engagement at the youngest ages. Now, it doesn't take them long to master that. You don't have to spend 2 years doing that. Literally within months, they figure it all out.
Success.
With little kids, it's just a matter of coordination and dexterity, you know, and the ability to move their body in a certain way. They don't quite have the hand to eye, foot to eye coordination or the dexterity that you and I might have yet, right? The ability to bend their body, move their body. But once you work with them on these specific things, they start to master that. Once I get them to a position to where they're good enough doing that, right?
Yeah.
And then I just take that segment of my training away and expand my positional play.
Okay.
For them, because now the positional play is under pressure, right? I mean, they're having to have a good first touch away from pressure, receiving on their back foot, making a proper pass with the proper amount of weight. That's also when the scanning starts, right? The learning to, you know, look around, make my decision before I get the ball, and learning how to become a decision maker. You have to teach a kid how to make a decision. I think that's another place that clubs make a mistake. They say you need to make good decisions, and a kid doesn't know what the decision-making process is.
Yeah.
He has no idea what that looks like, right? How to make a decision. First you scan, then what are we looking for when we're scanning, right? Ask them that question. I do. I was like, what are you looking for when you, I don't want you just turning your head, right? What are you looking for when you're turning your head? What are you looking for? Tell me about it, right? We're looking for opponents. We're looking for space. We're looking for teammates, right? This is what you're looking for and why you're looking for it. So I don't think clubs break that down enough. They just simply go, hey, that was a bad decision.
Yeah,
they don't
check your shoulder. But yeah, it's like, and what are they actually looking for? Yeah, exactly. So, breaking down and asking those questions, really important.
Yeah. So breaking it down and then constantly coming back to it as reminders is a big deal. It's just a matter of how you teach the kid that helps them absorb the information faster.
So you've went from your, you know, the technical work of, you know, passing, receiving, and you've moved into a positional game or a rondo situation. So now there is pressure. What would that look like in your session?
Well, at first it looks a little sloppy, right? I mean, the first time they try it, it's a little bit like I said, sloppy. It's a little bit confusing to them and whatnot. But by the end of one practice, they generally have it.
Yeah.
Right. By the end of the training, they've got the general idea. I posted a video not that long ago of my 2016s running a 4v3 rondo, where the three players in the middle had balls at their feet to slow them down. And the reason why I used three players is because I wanted to create gaps to be able to pass through.
That's true.
Right. So rather than using one player who's running around with no ball at their feet, right, I used three players, put a ball at their feet. They're trying to change directions fast, so they're getting plenty of touches and dribbling touches on the ball. And then the passers are starting to see what gaps look like, gaps in space. Right.
Inside players are trying to intercept them. Yeah.
Yeah, they're trying to get in the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just a matter of designing a training that helps them learn what we're looking for, what on a field, right? And now they actually have the ability to run a 2v2 plus 2, where they have two target players and a 2v2 in the middle, right? And now we're talking about transition as part of the game. Right, going from offense to defense when you lose the ball, and it's just a matter of how you explain it to the kids.
I think that's a very creative way as well. especially at that age, you know, for every kid to have a ball, because you know what it's like, that sharing the ball at that age, I find is tricky, you know. But if those players in the middle that are trying to regain possession or getting in front of the passing line, they actually have a ball as well, you know, they're getting the touch work in. But I'm sure that's fun, you know. It's just a great creative way to introduce that that rondo, that 4v3 rondo, you're saying. That's great. So then the 2v2, sorry, go ahead.
I was saying, I have the experience. I mean, we're talking about 25 years now of experience for me of working with kids in this age group, right? And so I have the experience. A big mistake that a lot of clubs make is they put a low experience coach with low experience players, right? And they take the young guy coming out of college, just working on his licenses and badges for the first time, you know, and doesn't have a lot of experience working with this. And I was in that position at the YMCA, right? And so I know how overwhelming it can be. And so a kid's not going to get a lot out of that. And so you really, what a club needs is a highly experienced coach to work with these low experienced players. You can't put low experienced coaches with low experienced players. You just can't do it, because then you're going to end up with a mediocre to poor result in your development.
I think that's fantastic that, because you know yourself, you get a bit more experience, and all of a sudden, you know, you're wanting to climb the ranks. You're wanting to coach the, you know, the A teams or the, you know, the high school kids. But for someone like yourself to have a lot of experience and go and coach at the foundational level, I think that's a great thing that SG1 do, that those players from their foundational experiences with soccer, they've got, you know, a coach that's going to show them, you know, just in terms of your sessions, you've got your ball mastery section. They're getting that essential touch work, but they're also getting the knowledge of spacing, of possessional play. I think that's great what you guys are doing.
And so with our methodology, you know, as players improve, right, we phase out the individual aspect of the training and phase in more positional play. I mean, we're phasing out the technical aspect and phasing in more positional play, more of the phase of play training, and those kinds of things. And so, because I believe as a club coach, that we, you know, the hours that we have the players in the collective groups, we need to work on the things that are best worked on in the collective, like cognitive player development, decision making, spatial awareness, all right, those kinds of things. And that's kind of what Tovo is about, right? It's about building in more intelligent players, as decision making, both on and off the ball, is a skill. It's a skill like any other skill. It's a skill like shooting, it's a skill like passing and receiving or dribbling. And the more you do it, the better you're going to become at it. And so what our methodology does is it's constantly over and over and over again, hopefully thousands of times per training session, putting kids in decision-making situations to where both on and off the ball. And so constant ball rolling time. And that's what it's about. Kids are a lot of kids are at the mercy of their physical development, right? I mean, some kids develop later in life, some kids develop earlier in life. So a lot of kids are at the mercy of their physical development. Almost none of them are at the mercy of their mental development, right? Sure. And so if you can develop kids as early as possible between the ears, right, then as their physique develops, as their athleticism, their size, speed, and strength develop, they'll already have the tools here to make this better. And so you don't have to wait for a kid to be coordinated or be athletic to teach them how to play the game. sure. Or to recognize space, to recognize off of the ball movement. As a matter of fact, you're doing that kid a disservice if you don't. The kids who grow and groom late, you're doing a massive disservice, because you can help them out by teaching them, you know, if you move from here to here, right, you're going to have an extra step of time to make that touch, right? You won't get overpowered by another player's physical abilities because you're smarter in your positioning, right? Because you're smarter in your playmaking. I've got players on some of these teams that don't have a lick of athleticism in them, right? Not an athletic bone in their poor bodies, but they're such good decision makers. They're always in the perfect shape. They're always in the perfect space. They're giving themselves plenty of time. They never turn the ball over. They know when I should pass, where I should pass, when I should dribble, you know, how to lure a player into me to create space for my teammates, right? But you don't have to be super athletic to be able to do all of that. Sure. Right? I mean, the best player in the world for the last decade or more is 2.5 inches shorter than me and 35 pounds lighter, right?
Sure. I think you're right, too, about getting including those activities at a young age. I remember when I used to work up in New York, and you would get some players that had moved in town from Venezuela, or and all of a sudden, you know, even in countries like that, South America or Europe, and they'd been in environments where they were, you know, doing rondos really early or passing activities early, and the difference was just, you know, their ability to make decisions was, you know, and I'd maybe be getting them at age 10, but the work had been done, you know. So going back to your point, I thought that was awesome. What would be the main concepts that you would be trying to implement from that, like U6, U7, U8 age groups? What would you, in terms of possessional play at that age, would you be encouraging during the games that they would rotate the ball, switch the ball? What sort of things are you trying to, you know, implement there?
So what I'm really looking for is for kids to, once again, make good decisions there, sure, right? You want to teach them to play simple first, right? That's the hardest thing to teach, right? A kid to just relax. Every kid wants to go forward, right? Every kid always wants to dribble. They want to go forward. And that's great. We want them to have that ability to do that when the time is right to do it, though, sure, right? I've been accused in the past of being a passing coach. I'm not a passing coach. I'm a decision-making coach. It's just that the right decision 95% of the time is to pass the ball. I mean, even Leo Messi passes the ball on 9 out of every 10 touches he gets it, right? He passes 50 to 60 times a game. He makes about 4 to 4.5 dribbles per game on average. That's it, right? So, and he's the best dribbler in the world. So if he's going to pass the ball 9 out of every 10 touches, who am I to say otherwise, right? And it only gets better from, you know, and it only gets, the disparity only gets bigger from there. I mean, how many times a game do you think Kevin De Bruyne passes it, right? So it's just that the majority of the time, right, the right decision is to make a good pass, right? You can use that pass for a lot of things, creating an opportunity for your team, breaking down the other team off the, you know, and splitting lines, securing the ball back to a safe place. So all I'm looking for is a good decision. That's all I'm wanting them to do, right? Is make good decisions. And then we talk about those good decisions is what we do. And I help them find that decision on their own by using guided discovery or you know, saying, hey, you might freeze the game and say, hey, where do you think you can move? He's got the ball over there. Where do you think you can move from here to help that player out a little bit better? I mean, because right here, you're kind of behind, right? And so it's just about talking to the kids. The kids get it. They're super intelligent. And so it's just a matter of creating a culture where they feel like, A, they can talk to you, right, about something, and B, you can talk to them and it doesn't feel like criticism or judgment. So
I love how you're asking questions there too. You're asking, where could I be, rather than going, you know, hey, Johnny, move here. You're not open, you know, but if that kid has the decision and the thought process to go and do it themselves, then it's going to stick, right?
And that's part of that why. Why am I doing this? Why should I do this? You know, once they learn that why, then they can apply it in every situation in the game. Soccer games, no 2-1 is alike. It's not like baseball where you hit the ball and you run to first, right? It's the same thing. And it's the only game where the players are the decision makers. In every other sport, at least here in the United States, the decision is being made by somebody else as a general rule, right? I mean, in baseball, the coaches call the pitch, or they tell a player when to steal or run or whatnot, right? In football, you have coordinators and head coaches that are calling the plays on the field, right? In basketball, you've got timeouts and you've got coaches saying, hey, you know, run the pick and roll and do all of this, right? That doesn't happen in soccer. Soccer, the players are the decision makers. And so we have to be willing to teach them to be the decision makers on the field. And they have to understand the game so that they're making correct decisions. And so I think that's the hardest thing to get across. I think there's pros out there that don't understand the game that well. And so it's something that we've got to start ingraining into our kids at a very, very young age.
Yeah, I mean, well put. I'd love to come and observe one of your sessions sometime. You know, so you've moved from your ball mastery section, went into your technical passing receiving section. You've then went into your positional play or rondo sort of situation where you've got maybe a 2v2 plus two. How would you, you know, so you said, you know, the first couple of sessions are a little bit sloppy and stuff, and then they get it, and then they start getting grasping that activity from like a 2v2 plus two, like you said. Like, how would you add complexity to that as they start to understand it and grow their ability to play?
So when I started out, it's usually a pretty sizable grid,
yeah,
right? It's a lot of space to work in, so that they can A, build confidence in the training itself, and B, build confidence in themselves, right? Confidence is probably at the top of the list of things that I want to give a player, right? It's being fearless, being confident in themselves, and being confident in me that I'm teaching them the right things, right? So we want to find a certain amount of success with them early on in these trainings. And so as they start to improve, right, one of the things that I'll start doing is shrinking the size of the grid, reducing the amount of space, making it so that they have to make their decisions quicker because the pressure players are much closer. So if you reduce a grid as much as just 2 yards in either direction, that's a big deal. And it becomes much, much tighter for them. There's a huge difference between a grid that is 20 yards long to a grid that is 18 yards long for these kids, right?
Speed of play just needs to, you know, be a lot faster, right?
So yeah. The speed of play, right? And so, which means the speed of their decision-making. And that's what I teach them. You can play faster without actually moving your body faster because you're moving your mind faster, because you're making decisions quicker, okay? And then it starts to look effortless, because it almost is. You know, when kids start playing, they're making decisions in the wrong manner. And this is what I mean by teaching kids how to make decisions. Generally, they receive the ball, then they look up, then they make their decision, and then they make their action. That's how they learn to make decisions, and that's all the wrong way. Okay. And so they have to learn that look up, make my decision, receive the ball, then act, right? So you have to teach them the decision-making process. Kids won't know that if you don't tell it to them. I mean, we don't know anything until it's explained to us as humans, right? And so you have to explain to them that this is how we make decisions. You should always have your decision made before you get the ball, and that'll make your life a lot easier.
Sure.
And so once they grasp that concept and they start doing that, then the sky's the limit for them, right? Yeah. I mean,
you add more players, then you're going 3v3 plus three, or
yeah, and then it grows. Yes, then you're going to 3v3 plus two, 3v3 plus three. Now we're adding a center neutral, right? Somebody to play through in the middle, a pivot player, sure, if you will, right? And then it, you know, maneuvers its way all the way up to, say, a 4v4 plus 3 eventually down the road. Wow. And so I've even figured out how to add shooting into it and get my goalkeeper's work. So it's just a process, and it's a process that you have to stick by. Now, the hard part is that what I'm asking the players to do, what we're asking the players to do over at SG1 is very hard. It goes against all of their natural instincts, right? Playing possession, making good decisions, being simple, being patient. That's against everything a kid is, yeah, right? Kids are very impatient by nature. They want things. They want them now. They want to go fast. They want to do it, you know?
Very egocentric at that age. To teaching a kid to share the ball is a challenge at that age, I'm sure. 6, 7 years, yeah, 8 years old.
And to teach them that sharing the ball might actually help them out, you know, by you passing the ball away, the pressure leaves you. You can get the ball back in even more space and more time and take advantage of that off the dribble now, right? So it's teaching them how all of this works together. And so it's just as you progress through the trainings, you make them a little bit tighter, a little bit more complicated, and just to make sure they understand why they're doing what they're doing, because the why matters a lot.
Yeah. And then maybe U10, U9, are you then passing this group that you've worked with to another coach?
So yeah, we've set up, our coaches stay with specific age groups. They don't move with the teams, right? So I have, you know, grassroots U6, U7, and U8 is my primary goal, right? Those are my primary age groups. And I pass them on to the next coach who has U9, U10, U11. Right. And so we have a coach there, and then he has a series of other coaches that might work with second team and whatnot as well.
Sure.
So, and then he will pass them on, you know, to a coach who works with U12, U13, maybe U14. Right. So the coaches stay in those age groups, and the coach that I'm sending the players on to knows exactly where I'm leaving off. And I'm having these conversations with him as we're moving the players, right? As we're moving the teams. Look, here's the players. This is where we're at. This is what we're working on. And this is what we're learning, you know?
Sure.
But in the early phases, like I say, we're going against the player's nature. And you can't be worried about, say, winning a bunch of titles and games and stuff like that, right? That comes later. And because what I'm asking them to do is complicated, and it requires thinking. There's going to be hesitation on their part in games and stuff like that early on. And so it requires patience on the parents' part, which is another thing that I do, parent education. That's part of my role at the club as director of player development is parent education, right? So a couple of times a year, I'll hold seminars or meetings with the parents, either in person or, say, over a Zoom or something like that. And we talk about what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're doing it with the kids, right? Why this matters and what we're looking for out of you as a parent, right? And so we have discussions on things like, what does it mean to be a sports parent? What is expected out of me as a sports parent? Developing players at home. What do I need to work with at home with my young players? The parent-coach relationship, the dynamic, right? We have I have discussions with them over these kinds of topics. And so usually if you're a club and you want to reduce the amount of screaming and yelling that's happening at the sidelines, right? And so that comes from parents that have either a lack of understanding of what you're trying to do as a coach or as a club, a lack of trust in their kids' ability to do something on the field. And they feel the need to control everything, right? Like a video game, right?
Yeah.
Or a lack of belief in me as the coach, right? That's the only reasons a parent should feel the need to yell. Other than that, they should sit back, relax, and just enjoy their kid playing.
Yeah.
So we have to have these conversations. Some parents, it doesn't matter. No matter how many times I talk to them about it, they can't help themselves. But for the most part, you know, we have a relatively, we can have a relatively quiet sideline, you know, because we're having these discussions with the parents. So parent education is one of the big things that I do with the club. Awesome. And then the other thing I do is I coach the coaches. So I float in between training sessions. When I'm not training, I might float and work with the coaches. And, you know, I work with them on things like how to get the most out of their training sessions and how to get the most out of the kids they're training. Learning to identify the trainings that their team may need, right? So their team may be proficient in one thing and have a weakness in another. And so we might discuss, you know, how to work on that. And so I float from training to training, working with especially the younger coaches, the least experienced coaches. I am generally trying to work with them. A lot of times those coaches will shadow me on my trainings as well.
And then they'll go in and implement it on their own sessions. That's fantastic. One topic I wanted to raise with you at the minute, just whilst we're, you know, conclude, is obviously I know that it's tryout season for you guys at the minute. Yep. How's that going for you in general?
Good. We don't build teams through tryouts. It's not something we do. We fill holes and gaps as a general rule. So we don't generally build teams through tryouts, but we're getting a lot of inquiries. And you know, obviously we're happy with that. We're happy to have a lot of interest in the club. So not everybody will get selected. Now, when younger players come to try out, we generally, everybody there is if they're not ready to jump into, you know, a 2014 team, you know, a U8 or a U19, we have those age groups in our development program, our recreational/development program. And so we may say, hey, what we'd like you to do is let's put your player in this program for now. We're going to work on their technical abilities, right? We're going to work on them learning the terminology and what we do here and those kinds of things. And then we can find a way into a more competitive environment down the road for them. We want to make sure that, so if you take the 2015s, for instance, right? If you've seen them play, they move the ball around pretty well. A kid coming from a recreational program wanting to jump into our club, right? That would be a difficult environment to put that young player into, right? It would be very difficult because they may not end up touching the ball the whole practice, right? And that's not what we want for that player. It's like for that kid, it'd be like learning how to swim by being thrown off a pier and into a lake, right? And that's not confidence building. And so it might take a season or two because a lot of those kids started with us when they were like four, right? I mean, they're U7s. They've already been here 2 years, and so that's a different 6-year-old, right? And so you want to make sure that you're placing the players in the appropriate environment for their development to build their confidence, to build their understanding of the game, to make them feel better about playing, to help them fall in love with both the ball and the game. Once you help a kid fall in love with the ball and the game, they'll take it from there a lot of times, right? Because they'll be training on their own at home. They'll want to juggle, they'll want to dribble, they'll want to play with the ball at home. And when the ball becomes the kid's favorite toy, that's when development generally just explodes in a kid.
Yeah, when they just love spending time on their own. What I was going to ask you was that, you know, as player development director, how would you sell it to a parent what team their player was on? For instance, you know, you've got, obviously there's stigma with an A team and a B team. A PD1 I've been calling our a development team. But how would you sell it to parents that this is going to be the best environment for your child right now for the play on this team?
So being on the first team, second team, third team, whatever, is not is not an indictment of your player's future. It's not. It's where your player's development level is right now. That's all it is, right? And being on the second team or third team doesn't mean that they have a less future than the first team. With us, the third team players and the second team players are just as important as the first team players. They get top-notch coaching. And I float between second and third teams myself, right? And even though I'm the coach of a first team, right? I work with the second. And sometimes if we're working side by side, I may switch coaches right then and there, right? I may halfway through practice, I might say, hey, would you go run my 4v4 plus three over here with them? I want to take a look at these guys for a little while, right? And work with them. And so it happens. And it helps me understand where each player is, maybe who's ready to move on, right? Who's developing and stuff. But I don't want them looking at it as, you know, first team, second team, third team, more important, somewhat important, not important at all, right? That's not what that means. It means the kid on the third team needs an extra space of time to control the ball, pass the ball, you know, those are make a decision, right? And that's really all it is. It's not an insult to be on that team. And every player has the opportunity. The club is fluid. The players can move around, right? Nobody is stuck on the team they're on. And so as your player has the opportunity to move. And if they develop faster than somebody on the first team, right? I'm moving. Last season, I moved three players off of my U9's second team to the first team. And it was because the kids had worked hard. They had developed hard. Spot came open. One or two spots came open, right? From players moving away. One kid moved to Europe, back to Europe with his family, right? So, you know, and if a teams almost never stick together. All right. You'll hear parents go, man, if this team sticks together for a long time, we're going to be great. It's not sticking together.
Yeah.
All right. It never happens.
Yeah.
So let's get 25 years. They never stick together for that long. Yeah.
I think that's a great point what you just made there about, you know, there's no shame on being in a development team. It's like, sometimes I feel, you know, I get a lot of it that iron sharpens iron. Hey, I want this kid to play in the first team because I want them to play against that competition. But a lot of the times, you know, in the activities that you run, like you said before, like the kid won't touch the ball, you know, and they're getting less time on the ball because they'll get it taken off them, or they'll be chasing shadows the whole time trying to win the ball back. But if they're actually allowed time on the ball, you know, they have more time to make decisions. Maybe they're getting more touches, more decision-making opportunities in that, I guess, the lower level, we want to say lower level, maybe slower level. That's going to push their development further. They're getting confidence, like you said before, as well. Getting that repeat action of, oh, a successful pass or receiving on the back foot. So I think that's a, you know, great way to look at it as well.
And really the only difference for us, I mean, our first team, second team, third team, they play the same methodology, right? They all play the same way. The only difference is the speed that they play it, right? That's it. The only difference is the speed of thought. And as a third team player improves in their speed of thought and their confidence, and then they're going to move up. If the whole team improves, I'll just move the whole team up a bracket. Right. It doesn't really matter. We've got second and third teams that are in the same bracket. There's no, that's not disrespect. Right. And so the parents need to understand that I want what's best for the player. Every coach should want what's best for the player, because what's best for the player is also best for the club. Right. And the two go hand in hand. We're doing what we think is best for the player in those instances.
Awesome, man. So what's your future ambitions in coaching looking like? I suppose it seems like you're pretty contented right now. Have you got any other?
I'm happy where I'm at. I don't have this massive desire to go on and coach in professional leagues, or I'm where I want to be.
Yeah.
Doing the things that I want to do, because I believe that it is incredibly important that somebody do this in a manner that helps players maximize their own development at the earliest stages, right? It's just an incredibly important job in my eyes. And it's taken for granted too much by too many clubs. And so I think that the best way that I can affect the future of soccer in my area, city, state, country is by helping get this as right as possible at the lowest age groups.
Yeah, hats off to you, man. Yeah, you've really made it a niche sort of job that you have, or just working with those age groups. Is there any other coaching licenses that have interested you that you might embark on?
No, you know, I've got the C, and I don't see a need to push further with what I'm doing. Sure. Right. I think with my particular, I don't think that the B license or the A license is fit what I do. The time and money that it takes to earn those. And there's people that need to go out and get those if they have higher aspirations of, you know, coaching at the highest levels, going USL and MLS and all of those other things, right? Yep. But it's better for me to continue to study things like child development, and how to communicate with younger players, and how to help build confidence in young human beings. So those are the things that we need to work on. It's no coincidence that the coaches that are doing such a great job around me that we've selected as a club to put in these age groups, most of them, their second job is teaching, yeah. Right? Our coach of the year, her name is Diana. She's a magnificent coach, and she's an elementary school teacher or something like that, right? And another one's a counselor in an elementary school. So they understand how to communicate with kids and what level you can communicate with them on, and how to get a lot out of them when you compress a little bit and when you need a little bit of compassion and empathy, right? And so having that understanding of how kids learn, how kids think, how to get the most out of a young person, that's super important at these age groups. And I can best help out by learning more about that than working on a B license or an A license.
I think it's like just, I think that's a big important thing as well, when you've got, you know, if you do a bit of education on actually communicating to a child at that age, you know, because I feel like sometimes I'll do it my own coaching where I'll say something, and I say it as if I was talking to an adult. Maybe I'm like, I really need to have a funnier phrase, or, you know, something that's just going to get the kids on side with how you communicate. So I think that's a fantastic thing, mate. But Michael, I really appreciate you coming on today and all your work.
Thanks for having me, man.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks. I'd love to get you on again if we could talk about maybe a parent education episode dedicated to that. You brought that up today, and I think that's super important that, you know, we really for clubs that we communicate what we're trying to do here with parents. But really appreciate your time today, man, and hopefully have you on again soon, Michael.
Thank you. Love it.